Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the indictments against Paul Manafort and his associate Rick Gates, unsealed today, and the surprise smoking gun that ties the Trump campaign to Russia, with charges against Trump's former foreign policy adviser George Papadopoulos, who was arrested by the FBI back in July and has been cooperating with the special counsel since then. Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, joins us to discuss the role of George Papadopoulos, who was acting in collusion with higher-ranking officials in the Trump campaign in attempting to deliver dirt on Hillary Clinton and thousands of emails to the Trump campaign from a professor with links to the Kremlin who he met in London in March, which he lied about to the FBI. Since Papadopoulos told the Trump campaign about the thousands of emails on Clinton hacked from the DNC in April, months before their existence was made public by WikiLeaks in July of 2016, it is likely the Trump campaign had access to this material much earlier. Then we'll look into the Manafort indictments with someone who knows him and his work in Ukraine, which is central to the case against Trump's former campaign manager. Anders Aslan, a former Swedish diplomat in Moscow who served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine, joins us to discuss the money laundering charges from the $75 million that Manafort funneled through overseas shell companies and the $60 million in personal loans that he got from a Russian oligarch close to Putin, and the lavish lifestyle the indictments charge Manafort with, noting $1.3 million he spent on expensive clothes. Then finally, we will speak with Liz Kennedy, the Director of Democracy and Government Reform at the Center for American Progress. She joins us to question why Trump hired a campaign manager who was now exposed as an amazingly greedy crook. We'll examine how much Trump shares Manafort's disdain for democracy and the rule of law, since his campaign manager's whole history as a lobbyist in Washington has been that of representing third world dictators, kleptocrats, and criminals like Mobutu, Marcus, and Suharto. And joining us now is Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Scott. And today, of course, has been a fairly momentous day with the release of the indictments and the arrests of Paul Manafort and Richard W. Gates III. But it turns out the big surprise here is that back on July the 27th, George Papadopoulos, who was worked on the Trump campaign, he was initially supposedly an energy consultant, but clearly had a role in terms of the Russian interference. He was arrested on July 27th when he landed at Washington International from a flight from Germany. And on March the 24th, days after Papadopoulos was identified as one of Trump campaign foreign advisors, he met with a professor in London who had connections to the Kremlin, and apparently he's in trouble with the FBI, which is why they arrested him, because he told the FBI that the meeting where the Russians said they had dirt on Hillary Clinton took place before he joined the campaign, but that wasn't the case, that the emails and the claims came later when he was actually working on the campaign and where he arranged a meeting between the campaign and the Russian government and emailing a senior policy advisor in the Trump campaign about some interesting messages coming in from Moscow about a trip when the time is right, et cetera, et cetera. So is that right, that he basically got in trouble lying to the FBI about when he was actually working with the campaign and when this approach was made to the Russians?
Yes, I would say, first of all, I would say this was the big surprise for the day. So I think the indictments of Manafort and Gates were widely anticipated. The subject matter of those indictments, I don't think, surprised anybody who's been following it. It's pretty much as expected. But Papadopoulos came as a shock. His name had come up really only a couple of times. And today we discover that, as you noted, in July he had been arrested, and on October 5th he'd even had his plea hearing and the federal district court in Washington, and not a word got out about this in the news today. And I think it is, you know, much more direct evidence of collusion than we see in Manafort, which is indirect. But your description is correct. That is, you know, his lies had to do with two things. They had to do with the timing of his dealings with the Russians, which he was occurred before he joined the campaign. But they also had to do with the substance of what was discussed and done, which he tried to downplay and minimize, and this reveals to have been far more substantial. And it included working with individuals who are, I think, from the complaint, appear to be under suspicion of being Russian intelligence operatives, including an individual named the professor. Lots of speculation going on in the world of investigative journalism now as to who that is, and a Russian female, also the subject of a lot of speculation right now.
But given that he was Papadopoulos was arrested on July the 27th, and that he's been cooperating with the FBI and with the Mueller investigation ever since, it would seem to me that the timing here is so important, where Papadopoulos found out that the Russians had thousands of emails on Hillary Clinton, and he found this out before the hack took place of the DNC and before John Podesta was hacked back. And he of course, was hacked in October and the DNC in July of 2016.
Let's say at least it's in immediate proximity to the time the hacks actually occurred, which is pretty amazing.
Right.
So this would suggest that there was a discussion of collusion and use of this material in real time as the hacking operations were going on. And there was a clear disclosure to a senior figure in this campaign that the Russians had done it and were very proud of what they had and thought it could be profitably used in the campaign.
Well, that's what I've always assumed, that if you hack the emails, you do it for a purpose, and that you'd use them in real time because you're basically reading the opposition's mail, and it would be a great advantage to the campaign to have this kind of intelligence. You couldn't get anything better than that. And the fact that Papadopoulos was talking about this before the leaked emails of the DNC were made public, it's pretty extraordinary. They were talking about in April, and they weren't made public until July.
I think that's right. And of course, today you have the White House pushing back aggressively, saying, hey, it's just this one guy, Papadopoulos. You know, he made some mistakes. He made some misrepresentations. It's just him. It didn't go anywhere. But if you go back and you read the statement of offense, which is like an indictment here, it lays out in tremendous detail about how he's doing all of this in coordination and discussion with more senior figures in the campaign. They're listed, they're discussed. So it's not him off on his own doing this. He's doing it in consultation, under the direction and supervision of far more senior managers in the campaign. And he's reporting back to them on everything that occurs. So very serious stuff. And I think, you know, when the president tweets today, no collusion, the big surprise is, I think this was an expectation that today we would be talking all about Manafort and that the feds and Mueller would not have any evidence of direct collusion with Manafort. But instead, we get alongside Manafort this dropped, in which it really is all about collusion.
And again, I'm speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. So in one email, there's talk about a high-ranking campaign official, which was forwarded, he had forwarded Papadopoulos' email to another, you know, email talking about the professor and getting dirt on Hillary to another official. And these officials in the Trump campaign were basically saying that somebody at a low level in the campaign would be the person to work with. So when the Trump people talk about how he was a nobody and he was a volunteer, etc., which is not true because Trump himself referred to him in a Washington Post interview in 2016, Trump said he's an energy consultant, an excellent guy. But now they're saying he's a nobody and a volunteer. But it looks as though the Trump campaign knew exactly how to use him, that the best way to deal with the Russians and with this material was to do it at a lower level.
That's right. And the footnote that you're referring to there in the statement of offenses actually talks about Donald Trump. It says it has to be understood that the meetings that are going to happen with the Russians to discuss this coordination and working together can't involve Donald Trump himself. It has to be a lower-level person. And what the White House is saying today is, hey, that meeting never occurred. But, of course, we know that Carter Page, you know, who's another one of the, these assistants who was identified in that Washington Post board interview, we know that he went to Russia in this time. Of course, there's suspicion that that may be the meeting, or there could be a number of other meetings that occurred. So, again, this is a significant nugget, something close to being a smoking gun, pointing to collaboration.
So, given that Papadopoulos was identified by Trump at the Washington Post editorial board meeting, and then just days after that, he met with this professor in London who had substantial connections to the Kremlin and offered all this dirt on Hillary Clinton that you were mentioning earlier, Scott, that there's a lot of speculation about who the professor might be. But the woman that he met with as well, that wasn't Veselnitskaya, was it? The lawyer that met Donald Trump Jr. and Darren?
Well, let's take them one at a time. I mean, what we know about the professor, again, from the information and the statements of the Department of Justice, is that he's London-based. He's referred to all the time as the professor, and we know he's someone who figures in the Valdai conference and was in participation in the Valdai conference in 2016 in Sochi. And if we just cross-reference all those facts, we come up with only a couple of people, and one who seems to fit the description extremely well, and that is a Maltese former diplomat named Joseph Mifsud. So that he'd be my guess right now as to who the professor is. But I think he's the only person I see who seems to match up on every point in the information. And also a person who's well known for his deep connections with Russia and the Kremlin. And I would say he uses the name professor all the time, but isn't actually an academic. And then the woman, of course, was described to him at one point, or he believed that she was a relation of some sort of Vladimir Putin's. And if you deal with Russian operations around the world, this frequently women agents are described as having some sort of relationship with Putin to pique interest and to convince people that they're working with that this is an important person. I've seen that happen in operations in many, many places and discussions of them. In Africa, amongst others. So that's being said, but then it turns out she's not. But again, she seems to be based in London, and this is bearing out something else we've discussed before, Ian, which is that one of the main scenes for a lot of the staging and activity seems to be in London. So remember, we have a lot of the information originally breaking here through the actions of British intelligence, MI5, MI6, GCHQ. So here, key meetings and interactions going on right under their nose.
And of course, we know that General Flynn, who was chosen as Trump's national security advisor, it looks as if he fell into a Russian honey trap in Cambridge with a Russian graduate student who has ties to the FSB, and they had exchanged love letters, Dear Misha, and all this kind of stuff. So are you suggesting here that the Steele dossier may have some of its roots in London via MI6, MI5, and GCHQ?
What I'm suggesting is that UK intelligence was all over this very early on, and as we know, was passing information on to the U.S. about what they were uncovering. Steele is, of course, running a private operation on the side, but I think most people in the UK would say, at least to some extent, you know, once a British intelligence agent, always a British intelligence agent.
Well, I think the FBI thought he was solid. Didn't they pay him a lot of money, which is what Trump is now trying to use to suggest that somehow there's collusion between Hillary Clinton and Comey, the guy who probably cost her the election.
I think Christopher Steele, of course, was well known to U.S. counterespionage and also to the FBI, and he had worked with the FBI on one of the big FBI success stories in the course of the last decade, which was the World Cup football and FIFA investigation. A lot of that, a lot of the success that the FBI achieved there turned on footwork that had been done by Chris Steele. So they obviously had, and I think still have, a very high, very positive opinion of him. That's totally apart from the so-called Steele dossier and the information he produced around, concerning Trump.
Well, but as you know, the White House is now clinging to that read as though it's their smoking gun, somehow turning the whole thing on its head and saying the guy that revealed information about Trump, some of which we can't talk about on the air, was working for Hillary Clinton, which is true that it was paid for by through opposition research. But the dossier itself was originally commissioned by or funded at the behest of Marco Rubio by Paul Singer, the billionaire hedge fund guy, right?
That's correct. I mean, you know, I had heard last summer that this was a Paul Singer project that others had picked up much later. So, yeah, so I think there's no question about the origins of it, and it was done as opposition research for the Rubio campaign, although Paul Singer, I think, was a supporter of Jeb Bush first, and then he switched to Marco Rubio later in the campaign. And then it was when it was completely clear that that Trump had the nomination stitched up, he dropped the project. And I think it's at that point that GPS Fusion peddled it to the likely opposition to Trump, the Democrats, and they picked it up.
So just in closing, Scott Horton, can the White House spin machine, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who does a pretty good job on their behalf, and Fox News, Rupert Murdoch talks to Trump every day, and he seems to be directing the campaign to make sure that in this alternative universe of Fox News and Sinclair, etc., they believe that Hillary Clinton is the devil and Donald Trump is the savior. And somehow, you know, even the fact, despite the fact that Hillary Clinton is not the president and Trump is, somehow she's responsible for all of our ills. Will they get away with this insanity?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, I think today, you look at what was going on Fox and coming out of the White House, they were ready for the announcement of the Manafort indictment. They had expected it, and they had a defense built on this just being a case that's running against Paul Manafort and others in his staff, saying that this antedates the campaign, no real evidence of collusion being produced, et cetera, et cetera. But I think they were really thrown for a loss with the Papadopoulos indictment, which is indeed direct evidence of collusion by the campaign during the campaign, and they've had no real response to that today.
Well, Scott Horton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Great to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Scott Horton. He's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers.